And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
What's making news? This was the week to remember the horrors of 9/11 of 5 years ago, and a week of increasing violence in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the president talked about World War III while students fell in Montreal. This week, we look back through time to other eras, and we look forward to what this globalizing world may be looking at when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As election time nears, passions increase. Everywhere we turn, we hear reports about the upcoming races, the battles for the House and Senate. No sense complaining. It's the countdown to the fall elections. And it's no secret that a whole lot of people who pay attention to environmental issues are investing their passions in this one because a lot is hinging on the outcome. We'll be focusing on the key issues that will be affecting the future of the natural world, the debate over public lands, global warming, wilderness, offshore drilling, energy independence, protection of endangered species. These things matter. In fact, they are critical. Predictably, of course, other issues are going to steal the spotlight. I mentioned just a few in the introduction to today's show. And this time, the war in Iraq will be playing a huge factor, as it should be. Today, I'm kicking off the show with a personal critique inspired by my recent trip to New York City. I find issues directly related to the future of the wild world almost everywhere I go. I'll be discussing some observations I made while visiting some of the amazing museums in the Big Apple. In segment two, we expand our nature and politics theme as we look to the future of our interdependent world, as we talk with a full-time globalist whose business it is to make real-world decisions about the future of civilizations around the world. We'll be visiting with a spokesman with the World Bank and get his take on global warming and globalization. And then this week, Congress approved the president's powers to direct the nature and scope of domestic spying. The decision for many represents a huge change in the very definition of democracy and individual liberties. But this is not really new in America. As a matter of fact, tucked away in the middle of a beautiful California valley is a National Park Service historic monument to a time past when citizens' lives were changed in time of war and their civil liberties overridden for national security. The monument exists for a good reason, and we close today's show with a visit to the legendary Manzanar. It's all coming up, but first the news. Pop quiz. Okay, answer the following question. What is the current status on oil drilling in the Teshikpuk Lake region? Okay, write down your answer. Now pass to the person behind you. The correct answer is... nope, you can't be drilling in the Teshikpuk Lake region right now. A federal judge issued a preliminary ruling which will temporarily block the administration's plan to allow oil exploration and development in the sensitive wetlands surrounding the legendary Alaska Lake, which total about 600,000 of the more than 13 million acres available for exploration and development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The ruling is based on the failure of the BLM to properly assess the impact that oil development will have on this sensitive area, known for its vast wildlife resources and its reputed oil reserves, estimated to come in at about 1.4 billion barrels. Environmentalists filed a lawsuit against the Department of the Interior, the state of Alaska, and oil companies in an effort to ban drilling and development in the sensitive area. Both sides have until September 15th to respond to the judge's orders. The leases are scheduled to be sold on September 27th of this year. Following the accidental death of the enormously popular crocodile hunter Steve Irwin, whose show was watched regularly by over 200 million people, a larger-than-ordinary number of stingrays are appearing dead on the shores along Australia's beaches, many with their tails or stingers cut off. Some authorities believe the rays have been killed in some kind of unusual retaliation for the death by the rays of the popular environmental celebrity. Australian authorities have appealed to the public to please honor the ethics of Irwin, who would never have sanctioned such actions in his name. Queensland state officials announced that 10 rays had been found dead along coastal beaches and 6 more were discovered in beaches to the north. Following a 170-year absence, northern fur seals are returning to their ancestral breeding grounds along the shores of the Farallone Islands, 27 miles outside the Golden Gate. The island once boasted an enormous population of northern fur seals, noted for their thick and luxuriant fur. In 1834, however, seal hunters slaughtered 200,000 of the creatures, after which the seals never returned. However, a few began returning in the early 1970s, but this year saw a sudden increase to 188 and growing this past week. The comeback is probably due to the high protection from human intrusion the Farallones provide, said Clyde Morris, manager of the Don Edwards San Francisco Bay National Wildlife Refuge. Okay, pop quiz 2. What is the height of the tallest tree in the world? Time. Okay, if you said 370 feet, you'd be right, but perhaps for only a short time, as it appears that 3 recent discoveries in the Redwood National and State Parks will push beyond the record-setting stratosphere giant, the name given to the record holder. 3 trees, the tallest measuring a sensational 378.1 feet and named Hyperion, seem poised to exceed the record holder. The thick canopy of California's redwood forest makes it difficult for researchers to locate and then measure these giants. The final decision will be made once the extremely long tape measure finally reaches the ground to confirm the winning height. And that's the news. The debate about the future of wilderness is not just between them and us. No, advocates for wilderness seem to be heading onto 2 different paths, and some are beginning to wonder if ever the paths will meet. You'll want to be listening for a special update to the wilderness debate coming up in the next few weeks. And please, when you hear about something relevant, if you have a concern or hear about a breaking story, contact me. You can write, phone, or email. I rely on you to help keep all of us informed. Okay. It's always good to get away, and I did this past week. I made my way through airport security in San Diego, boarded a plane, and landed in New York City. I got in late, but was up at the crack of dawn, despite the jaundice of jet lag, to head on out to the Met, that is, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, one of my favorite places. I bussed there from the Upper East Side, walked up the broad steps, and suddenly, the world changes. As you leave the ever-present now, to step into something that, in its own way, is much like a wilderness. The wilderness is a place that has taken thousands and millions of years to create, and contains the most magnificent monuments to the wonder. There's nothing cheap or frivolous in a wilderness, and the same standard exists in the vast expanse of the Met. As wilderness is a tribute to the hand of God or the mystery or whatever life is, the Metropolitan is a tribute to the most magnificent creations of our own long legacy. This legacy of the art of humanity is a celebration of our common sense of wonder and the capacity to sense and to take notice and interpret and create our own understandings of our place amongst the given backdrop of the earth. And it's apparent that civilizations through all time integrated their cosmology nicely with the truth. As in the wilderness and in nature, beauty runs rampant in the halls and on the walls of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's so obvious that humans share a common sense of awe. We have looked upon the earth and been moved to render the leaves and blossoms, the birds and snakes, and the four-legged creatures as powerful and significant beings. We have copied the designs and motifs of nature in endless expressions of beauty. This is a true manifestation of globalization. It is a globalization of common wonder, rather than the system to regulate the global plunder. The halls of the Met are filled with the human interpretation of time and importance. I visited the Mayan exhibit, which presented the efforts of a people of Central America who began their civilization around 1800 BC, who developed writing based on animal forms, and who wove sun and rain to corn as a truth of their world, adorned by the mystical animals that inspired them, the sacred cougar above all for its power, and then the frogs and ducks and birds and snakes and lizards that festooned their wares. The ancient cultures created monumental cities at all corners of the earth and filled their halls and dwellings with manifestly wondrous beauty and thrived for hundreds and even thousands of years. As an artist, I see through the eyes of the artists who took the stone and the clay, the paint and the metal, and crafted the endless beautiful lines, the long and sinuous, the soft and splendid, the miraculous and grand. And I am taken by the common sense of beauty that is within the human species. I long to live in a world so integrated, but it was time to leave, and so I did. I walked through the grand doors and overlooked my civilization. And there was so much to be honored, locked in the brick and mortar, the lamp posts and fashion. It exists. But it gets so drowned by the horns and the snarling buses and the signs and posters and scribblings and pavements. The next day I went to the Cooper Hewitt Museum, where I was blessed to see a show celebrating three of my favorite artists. Frederick Church, who celebrated the spiritual beauty of the earth in his romantic oil paintings of the divine landscape. Thomas Moran, whose paintings, particularly of the West, and most specifically of Yellowstone, were instrumental to the establishment of Yellowstone as our first national park, and Winslow Homer. I learned there how these artists helped to identify the grand lands as a gift to the American people. And then I ended my trip with a visit to MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, where I managed to catch the closing day of an exhibit of the Dada artists, who forged a worldwide response in protest of the emergence of the modern age of machines and factories and the diminution of humans to the indifferent development of the 20th century, all in 1917. And that evening, I heard the president declare that these times were akin to a third world war emerging, in which the forces of good and evil will meet for the final battle. And we listen each day to the shocking new news of more death in Iraq, the showdown between Iran and us, and the senseless slaughter of students in Montreal. And then I flew out of New York City on 9/12. We've progressed into the modern era, and even perhaps beyond. We may have gone a bit too far in our quest for convenience and order. As the world becomes one, is it possible that the scale exceeds its legitimacy? I guess we'll have to hold our breaths and see. You know all too well, being wise to the ways of the wild, that life is a vastly interconnected, interdependent system. When we return, we talk with someone whose job it is not only to think about this, but to manage it, as we open the doors at the World Bank. Stay tuned.
Wildside News, with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Globalization. Good for the planet? Bad for the planet? It probably depends on your perspective. For those who see the roots of globalization formed in the secret societies of the 18th century, whose dreams for a one-world government were held and carried out by the secret hands of the Illuminati or the Freemasons, globalization may not be your cup of tea. Or was it the dreams of the wild-eyed intellectuals like the Dulles brothers who formed the seedling CIA? Or is it a natural evolution of life on Earth? Or the spiritual expression of the oneness of all humanity? Whatever it is, it's happening. And we talk with a real live globalist when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Say what you will about globalization, but the truth is, it's happening whether we like it or not. And the truth is, there are those whose job it is to deal with the effects of globalization because it is and will continue to have dramatic impact on the developing world, which will be pulled into this global change because they literally have no choice. One aspect of a globalizing world is now being felt as global warming or climate change. And some would say this is just some people talking. But for those whose job it is to look at the future and determine what consequence global warming could have on societies, cultures, villages, and indigenous people who will be faced with dealing with these effects, we go straight to the source to find out. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Robert T. Watson. He's the senior scientist and senior advisor with the World Bank. Dr. Watson, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
You've been involved with issues relating to global warming, actually going back to the time when global warming was probably first being discussed. Give us a brief intro to how it is that you come to this focus.
Yeah, I first focused much of my work on an issue called stratospheric ozone depletion, which is where we humans are destroying the ozone layer above us, leading to an increase of ultraviolet radiation at the Earth's surface, which then led to an increase in skin cancer cases. I then suddenly recognized that climate change was probably an even larger problem. And so in the late 1980s, I started to get involved in this issue of to what degree are we humans changing the Earth's climate and what are the implications of those changes to society.
As you know, this topic is one that has many different interpretations as to its real significance, et cetera, et cetera. At this point, where does the World Bank come in terms of its recognition of the significance of global warming?
Yeah, the World Bank recognizes it is a serious issue. There's absolutely no doubt the Earth's climate is changing, and it also is quite clear that most of that change is due to human activities. It's equally clear that the Earth's climate will continue to change over the coming decades, over the coming century. The reason the World Bank is extremely concerned about this issue is that climate change is likely to undermine our main goals of poverty alleviation and economic development in developing countries. The real concern is that climate change could adversely affect agricultural productivity in developing countries, adversely affect water resources, lead to an increase in sea level, potentially displacing tens of millions of people. Also, it could actually adversely affect human health through an increase in vector-borne diseases such as malaria and dengue fever or cholera, a waterborne disease in developing countries. So the reason the bank takes this issue seriously is we recognize that it could undermine development.
In terms of short-term risks that you feel the bank is going to have to start to address, what would you say are some of those short-term risks?
There's two approaches that we need to work with our developing country clients. First is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That is to say, make sure they get the energy they need for economic development, but try and do it in a climate-friendly way. And in particular, two countries are increasing their generation of electricity, for example, at an incredible rate, India and China. So our first short-term goal is to work with India and China to try and reduce their greenhouse gas emissions from their electricity sector. Secondly is adaptation. Here what we recognize is that many of our client countries are maladapted to today's climate variability. That is to say their agricultural systems, their water resource systems are actually not resilient to today's climate variability. So our first goal is to first understand how to help our developing country clients become less vulnerable to current climate variability, and then effectively, how can we make sure they're less vulnerable to long-term climate change. And the key issues are sea level rise in low-lying deltaic areas or small island states, and the second issue is how to make sure the agriculture and water sectors are resilient to climate variability and climate change.
It would be instructive if you have any examples where you're beginning to really have to address this at this point already.
Well, certainly we're already working with some low-lying areas such as in Bangladesh, a small Pacific island called Kiribati, to think through when sea level starts to rise significantly, what are their options? Do they retreat inland? Do they try and build seawall defenses? What options do they have? Now, Bangladesh has got options in the sense it's a fairly large country. But unfortunately, it's a very low-lying deltaic area where millions of Bangladeshis live. It's also where much of their agricultural productivity is. It's a very complex deltaic system. And so it's not clear what ensemble of strategies of retreat, building seawall defenses, will actually work. But there is a dialogue going on to actually understand what are the best options for the country. In a small country like Kiribati, we're trying to think through again what the options are, but this is a series of very low-lying atolls that sort of spread out across the Pacific Ocean where the highest point is only 1 meter high. And so they've got some real challenges of how to even deal with it, and we're working with them to think through what some of the options might be. We have a major study in India to think through how is the agricultural sector in India and the water resources sector in India already being affected by climate variability, and how might that effectively get even worse in the future. So we're trying to understand what are the coping strategies that can be developed to make the agricultural sector in India far less vulnerable to fluctuations in climate and more extreme events, etc.
There's many organizations around the world that are addressing this in various forms. How is it that the World Bank will play into these strategies to deal with these challenges?
The World Bank will work with all of the other major players, of course, especially the United Nations Environment Programme, the Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO in Rome, the World Health Organization in Geneva. Our major role is in implementing projects on the ground. And given that we have to work on the energy sector, the agricultural sector, the water sector, one of the issues we're looking at is to what degree are the projects that we're involved in, to what degree are they climate sensitive? In other words, are these projects, if the climate were to change, it would undermine the efficacy of the project? So we're building a screening tool that simply asks the question, on all of the projects we have on any sector throughout the world, is that project sensitive to a changing climate? And if it is, how could we redesign that project to be climate-proof, in other words? So we're trying to do that work, but we do collaborate closely with the other regional development banks, such as the African Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank. We're clearly trying to work much closer with the private sector, who are major players, of course, in development across the world. So we see our role is working with partners, both in other forms of international organizations and the private sector, and continuing a dialogue with our client countries on how to help them climate-proof their investments.
In terms of developing countries in particular, what specific areas do you think they should be addressing to deal with these problems?
Well, the most sensitive areas in the world tend to be the low-lying deltaic areas, small island states. They need to deal with the whole issue of sea level rise. But most countries in Africa are extremely vulnerable to a change in climate. And therefore, I would argue the highest priorities in many of the countries in Africa, certain parts of Asia and Latin America, is how to deal with the risk to water resource management and agricultural productivity. one of the basic problems is that throughout the tropics and subtropics, any increase in temperature is likely to lead to a decrease in agricultural productivity, especially in some of the areas where we already have famine and hunger today. Secondly, all of the theory suggests that areas that are already dry, the arid and semi-arid areas throughout Africa, Asia, Latin America, are likely to become drier in the future. The wet areas are likely to become wetter. And so the challenge is how to manage our water resources in areas where they're already dry today, they're likely to get even less rainfall. And those that already have probably as much or too much rainfall are going to get even more. So I would argue the two highest priority areas are managing water resources and agriculture. And then, as I say, on the low-lying areas, dealing with sea level rise.
Therefore, when you look out 25 years and even 50 years, which is what people in the World Bank are confronted, you have to do that. You have to be thinking out that far. As I look at this, if this were my job, I would say we're facing some real challenges, particularly as we look at this trade-off between alleviating poverty and promoting development. And because unfortunately at this point, the development, particularly as we watch China and India emerge, that seems to be focused around a fairly consumerist form of economic advance. And as you well know, that's where the rubber meets the road. We cannot just continue to consume. And therefore, there has to be some potential change of vision into a more sustainable global economy. Tell us what your thoughts are in that regard.
I mean, the two challenges are, first, how do we get energy, modern energy, to the 2 billion people throughout the world that don't have any access to modern energy services today? Many of these people, many of them in Africa, certain parts of Asia, their only form of heating is burning dung or traditional biomass, sort of wood. And when they burn it inside their homes, it leads to very high levels of air pollution, indoor air pollution, and literally millions of young children and women die every year. So the first challenge is to make sure they get energy for poverty alleviation. What we have to try and do is make it as clean as possible. In what we call our middle-income developing countries, such as India and China, they have a huge appetite for energy, not only for poverty alleviation, but for strong economic growth. The challenge there is how can they get the energy they need for poverty alleviation and economic growth, but in a clean form? And in fact, we're working with them literally as we talk. And the question is, as they increase their demand for electricity, how do we make sure that their coal-fired generation plants are the most efficient in the world? And over the next 5, 10, 20 years, can we even modify those plants with what we call carbon capture and storage? So we don't even release the carbon dioxide from a thermal coal-fired power plant into the atmosphere. It's a technology that's just becoming available. It probably won't be commercially available really throughout the world for another 10 or 20 years. But we're thinking through how does one provide clean energy that actually eliminates local air pollution and protects the climate system. And so the two sides of the story are the generation of energy. The other side of the story is the use of energy. Transportation is increasing rapidly in many developing countries, especially in India and China. How do we make sure the cars that are on the road are the most efficient you can get? How do we have mass transportation so people can use mass transportation, not individual vehicles? How can we have better land use planning so people don't have to drive or travel so far to work? And so the transportation sector is a very critical sector, but not only in developing countries. It's a critical sector in the USA and Europe. We're increasing our use of transportation. So how can we have a better transportation system, increase use of mass transport? And the second area on the use of energy is in the buildings. How can we make the buildings as efficient as possible and the appliances we have inside the buildings as efficient as possible? So in our dialogue with developing countries, we do talk about how do we produce the energy in the cleanest possible fashion, and we also ask the question, how can we use it in the most efficient way? If we can make progress on both sides of that equation, we can have the energy we need for poverty alleviation and economic growth without severe impacts on both local air quality as well as on the climate system.
Certainly, we see a lot of interest these days in clean energy sources, solar, wind, geothermal, et cetera, et cetera. But to address this, particularly the energy side of this, do you feel perhaps that the world really needs to address, even at a much larger scale, the development of these clean tech sources?
Yes, what we have to recognize is all of the projections suggest that over the next 10, 20 years, much of the energy will still be from coal, oil, and gas. So the first challenge is, how do we effectively make our utilization of coal, oil, and gas as clean as possible? Very efficient coal-fired power plants. We try to capture the carbon dioxide from these power plants. How do we make the use of oil in cars as efficient as possible? But in parallel to that, we have to try and work on scaling up our renewable energy sources. As you've said, solar, wind, geothermal, etc. Today, with the exception of large hydropower systems, modern renewable energy only accounts for about 3% of total energy production. So even if we double it or triple it in the next 10 or 20 years, it's still only going to be 6 or 10% of the total energy produced in the world. So we need to do research and development, and we have to get what we'll call the prices right to make sure that as we develop these new technologies, there's a way for them to penetrate into the marketplace. So we need a strategy of improving the technologies we've got today, trying to make them as efficient as possible, more research and development to improve the technologies, but we've got to get what I call the prices right. So as we do get more renewable energy technologies to be commercially viable, they are used. And one of the problems at the moment is we have huge subsidies in many parts of the world on fossil fuels, which actually limits the penetration of these clean energy technologies into the marketplace.
How do you see the World Bank really involved in creating really a whole new vision for sustainability on this planet? You're just one, you're a big organization, but you are just one. How do you interface and really unite all the various players in this? Because from my perspective personally, it's something that we simply must do.
Well, at the last G8 summit in Gleneagles, Scotland last year, they asked the World Bank to try to put together an investment framework to deal with clean energy and development. They asked us to work with the other regional banks, they asked us to work with the private sector, and they asked us to work with the International Energy Agency. So we're actually in the middle of developing an investment framework, and we've literally put it in sort of what I call three steps. First is, how do we get energy that is clean from a local and regional perspective to developing countries? And what are those technologies? What are the policies that are needed? What's the role of the World Bank? What's the role of the private sector? What's the role of our other regional banks? Then we ask the question, what additional do we have to do to make it climate friendly? So what do we need to do from a technology standpoint and a policy standpoint? And then we also ask ourselves the third question, given that we cannot stop climate change, it's already occurring, and some future climate change is already inevitable, how can we work with our client countries and the private sector and the other international organizations to adapt to climate change? So we're right in the middle of developing this paper at the moment, which addresses exactly what you're talking about. What is the role bank, the role of the World Bank? How can we work with the private sector? How do we work with other governments and with other international organizations to try and come up with a vision for clean energy? As we develop this paper, we've already been working with what we call the G+5. That's the five largest developing countries, China, India, Mexico, Brazil, and South Africa. We've already had detailed conversations with them, both with respect to energy generation and adaptation to climate change. And in the next sort of 6 to 9 months, we will expand our conversation with a very large range of developing countries to understand their vision for the future, their need for energy, their concerns about climate change. And as we do talk with developing country clients, we will simultaneously be working with the private sector and the other international organizations.
Dr. Watson, if people want to find out your role in all of this, and by the way, you're a very articulate spokesman, and you're creating a really wonderful perspective on what we're facing here and how the world has to unite, how can they find out more about that?
As soon as we've got this vision document more prepared, we will actually be putting it on a web system for people to actually comment. But they could go to the World Bank website, and they could actually look up, sort of go to the site that talks about our environmental projects, and go to the site that talks about our energy projects, and they can still soon get a very good idea of what we're trying to do in the energy sector, what we're trying to do in the environment sector. So we do have a website that has actually some very good descriptions of what our visions are for both energy and environment. And as soon as we further develop this paper on clean energy and development, we'll be putting that on a website, and actually we'll be soliciting comments from people as well.
Very good. Well, I know you're a very busy man. I can tell in our conversation here. Dr. Robert Watson, senior scientist and senior advisor with the World Bank, I want to thank you for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Global warming. It's real. Now, we need to deal with it.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
This week, Congress approved the President's request for additional powers during this time of war that appears to be headed into a war without end, for extending his right to abandon the protections afforded every American citizen. To many, it is changing forever the nature of democracy. But it has all been done before. In a moment, we visit the legacy of Manzanar, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. In a remote area of California, backdropped by the Sierra Nevada mountains, with vast panoramic vistas and a valley rich with productive apple orchards, war, World War II to be specific, made a stand right in the middle of this vast, serene place. Manzanar is a name many would like to forget. Manzanar is now part of our national park system. To tell us more about this historic site is Frank Hayes, superintendent of the Manzanar Historic National Historic Site. It's quite a story, and one which has very specific relevance to our world today. Frank, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. And you?
Doing great, thanks.
Frank, give us a picture of Manzanar when a world war changed forever this peaceful valley.
Well, in 1942, February 19th, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which put into motion the evacuation or removal or of Japanese Americans from what were called exclusion zones from the west coast of Washington, Oregon, and California to inland, one of 10 inland war relocation centers. Manzanar was one of those war relocation centers. It was opened in April of 1942, and its depopulation, there was over 10,000 Japanese Americans interned in the camp within less than a square mile, about 550 acres. And the War Relocation Center was made up of 36 blocks, each block having 14 tar paper barracks, a mess hall, a latrine, two latrine buildings, a men's and a woman's latrine building, and then some utility rooms. And each apartment barrack was split up into four separate apartments. The barracks were 20 foot by 100 feet long, and so each apartment was 20 by 25 feet. And right at the beginning, when the camp was opened, up to 8 people occupied each of the four apartments within the barracks. And it could have been 8 people from a single family or from different families. So it was definitely something, privacy issues and so forth that people were having to deal with right when
I'm just curious, to what degree were people able to bring in their personal belongings and make it?
Well, they were allowed two trunkfuls, basically, of their personal belongings. So, you know, there was 120,000 Japanese Americans impacted by the internment, and most of them either sold their belongings at cut rate prices, or you know, lost them during the war. There were some that had friends or churches that stepped up and took care of their belongings, their homes, or their farms while the Japanese Americans were interned, but the vast majority lost most of everything. And so, like I said, they could bring two trunks, essentially per person, into camp of their belongings. And, you know, it was hard for folks to know what to bring because they didn't know what to expect. You know, many of them were leaving kind of moderate, temperate climates were pretty harsh environments at one of the 10 camps, and so it was, you know, it was hard for them to pack and decide what to carry, and they didn't know how long they were going for or, you know, what kind of conditions they were going to face. So
I suppose the furniture was pretty much standard issue throughout the site.
Pardon?
I suppose that the furniture was this kind of standard issue throughout the...
Yeah, it was actually pretty Spartan, and in fact, you know, a lot of the folks, and one of the most compelling pieces, I think, in our exhibits are some beautiful pieces of furniture, dresser drawers that were made out of fruit crates from one of the camps. So, you know, the folks were, the internees were gathering up spare wood, thrown away wood, wherever they could, and were fashioning furniture out of that spare parts wherever they could, and some of it, you know, just this furniture we have on display is just absolutely beautiful, and it's created out of fruit crates.
Very interesting. By the way, people can see elements of the site as well as a map on the website, where you can click on that, and it will enlarge. So how long were people there?
They were up here for up to 3 years. In February 1943, the government, realizing some of the constitutional issues that they were facing and so forth, opened up the camps for people to relocate out of into the outside of the exclusion zone, so they had to have a job and guarantee that there weren't going to be any problems, and then have somebody sponsor them in the interior. Now, there were some people who had contacts and were able to do that, but quite a number were in camp for the entire 3 years. They closed. Those are closed finally in November of 1945.
Now, by the way, is it proper to refer to internment and relocation kind of in the same breath?
Well, you know, that's a terminology of how you describe the camps is something we, I don't say we would struggle with, but we definitely thought carefully about in dialogue with a variety of people and thought the best approach was to explain the wide breadth of terminology that's been used to describe the war relocation centers. We generally rely on the historic names, but we show and interpret the sites for everything they were called. Some folks here in the valley and other places refer to them as, you know, historically as Jap camp, and then it's all the way through to being called concentration camps. President Roosevelt called them concentration camps. And many in the Japanese American community prefer that they're called concentration camps today.
Well, let's
we try to interpret that breadth of terminology, and then allow visitors, invite visitors to figure out, you know, what that particular visitor thinks about the terminology and what happened out at the 10 camps.
So the camp was eventually over, and then what happened? And that relates to the question of what's there now today. So tell us that little story.
Well, there was. Manzanar was located on City of Los Angeles land. The City of L.A. has brought up much of the Owens Valley to preserve water rights. They export a lot of the Owens Valley water that comes out of Sierra Nevada down to Los Angeles. And so much of the valley floor is owned by Los Angeles, and the site where Manzanar is located was, during the war, World War II, owned by Los Angeles, and up until 1997, when the site was transferred over to the Park Service, was still owned by the City of Los Angeles. And so it had pretty much remained untouched. Now, all the buildings, there were 850 buildings that were residents of the campus, the road networks, the foundations, these incredibly beautiful rock gardens that the Japanese Americans constructed while they were here are present throughout the site, and those are all readily visible. And there's also a kind of an iconic cemetery monument out on the west side of the site that you know, there was an actual working cemetery, and there's actually still folks interred there.
Now, just recently, you had your grand opening for the Interpretive Center, and that's kind of an interesting story right there in terms of where the Interpretive Center is. It's giant. Tell us about that. We've got about a minute and a half left, so we'll move on rather quickly.
Okay, great. Well, the Interpretive Center was an auditorium building constructed by the internees in 1944. That building was occupied by the Inyo County for 50 years or more as their maintenance facility. The Park Service acquired that building and adaptively restored it into our Interpretive Center. So now we have 8,000 square feet of exhibits about the internment camps. We have two small movie theaters to show the 20-minute film we've produced about the internment. We've got a ranger information desk, a bookstore, and then our headquarters offices are all located right there in this Interpretive Center. So that's one of the three buildings that had remained from the camp period.
It looks like quite an interesting place, although I'm sure it has many mixed memories. Let's do two things. Let's tell people how they can go to your site literally and virtually.
All right, great. Well, we'll start out virtually. Go to NPS, like NationalParkService.gov, /MANZ, M-A-N-Z, and make sure you click on the in-depth section because there's many illustrations of the camp and the exhibits and so forth, much more in-depth information than you find on many other National Park web pages. We're quite proud of it. And then to visit the site personally, we're open 8:35 daily, Monday through Sunday, so 7 days a week, except for Christmas. And you can reach it by driving 4 hours north of Los Angeles on Highway 395. We're between the small communities of Lone Pine, California, and Independence, California, near the shadows of Mount Whitney.
Frank, thanks for being with us. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again on the Wild Side News.